From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the year 2014 draws to a close, we take a look back at some of the news and events of the past 12 months. First, we have this look at developments around the world from the United Nations.
From barrel bombs to beheadings, from the deliberate starvation of civilians to the assault on hospitals, UN shelters, and aid convoys, human rights and the rule of law are under attack.
In Iraq and Syria, spillover effects of conflict uprooted more than a million people. Foreign fighters used the power vacuum to get large areas under their control, shocking the world with extreme violence. President Barack Obama.
Nations are required to prevent and suppress the recruiting, organizing, transporting, or equipping of foreign terrorist fighters, as well as the financing of their travel or activities.
Israeli-Palestinian violence flared up in the wake of the kidnapping and murder of three Israeli teenagers in June. Weeks of conflict and retaliation left more than 1,300 Palestinians and 60 Israelis dead. People in Gaza had no safe place to go. More than 100,000 Palestinians sought shelter in UN schools. Six times UN schools were shelled. The only power plant was destroyed. Almost 500,000 people lost their homes. In Ukraine, an internal political crisis transcended into violent clashes in parts of the country, reaching full-scale conflict in the east. Conditions deteriorated, with serious consequences for the country's unity and stability. Despite a ceasefire agreement, the situation remains extremely fragile. In the Central African Republic, sectarian violence and reprisal killings between Christians and Muslims left the country fractured and traumatized. People marched with machetes through the capital, sending thousands to flee and hide in the bush. The UN mission's call for voluntary disarmament saw only low turnout. Cash for Work programs try to promote cooperation between the factions. In a tense security situation, 2 million people still need humanitarian aid. In South Sudan, the need for early action against human rights violations led to providing shelter for nearly 100,000 people at the UN bases. The logistical challenges were tremendous, especially during the rainy season. Peacekeeping clinics even had to deal with delivering babies. Security Council members traveled to South Sudan to urge the local leadership to engage in reconciliation and left disappointed. In 2014, the world counted more than 50 million refugees, the highest number since the end of World War II, a population that would make up the 26th largest country on Earth. Host countries and the UN were challenged to provide life-saving supplies and hope for a future. Women and children often suffered the most. Malala Yousafzai, who later won the Nobel Peace Prize, visited Zaatari Camp in Jordan to promote more accessible education for all children.
All have a dream. Some wants to become a doctor, some wants to become engineers, and some wants to become journalists.
Mourning in Guinea. When little Emil died, nobody imagined his village would become ground zero for the worst Ebola epidemic ever recorded. Spreading like wildfire, the disease turned Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia upside down. By December, more than 6,000 people had died. The living were paralyzed in fear. Economy and health services had nearly collapsed. At the UN Climate Summit, 120 world leaders joined forces with business, finance, and energy leaders and heard an urgent plea from Leonardo DiCaprio.
We are seeing extreme weather events and the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets melting at unprecedented rates, decades ahead of scientific projections. None of this is rhetoric, and none of it is hysteria. It is fact.
Imagine the
celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, UNICEF reminded to imagine.
Liberation Radio's Sean Garcia reviews some of the year's events both around the world and around the nation.
Earlier this year, we got reports from the growing struggle in the Ukraine. And we have here a sample of Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition reporting on the movement in the Ukraine against the neo-fascist leadership in that country.
Ukrainian government on July 1st canceled the ceasefire that both it and the rebels had abided by for 10 days before July 1st. And since that time, since July 1st, the Ukrainian government has been bombing and carrying out artillery attacks against its own people in eastern and southern Ukraine. Those people are always described as pro-Russian separatists or rebels, but these are the people of east and southern Ukraine. Their allegiances are not with the new coup d'etat government that seized power and then ratified its hold on power through a bogus election that they took power in February. The people in eastern southern Ukraine don't recognize the legitimacy of this government. They fear the government because it's loaded up with neo-Nazis. They fear the government because the government is hostile towards Russia and towards the Russian language-speaking people in eastern and southern Ukraine. As a matter of fact, right after the coup d'etat, the government announced that Russia would no longer be an official second language in Ukraine, signaling to that part of the population that they were going to be the targets of right-wing, xenophobic, nationalist, and semi-fascist persecution, which is a legitimate fear that they have. And because they organized opposition and then were hit back violently by the Ukrainian government, that opposition became an armed opposition. Under those circumstances, the Ukrainian government has taken a military offensive, bombing and shelling its own people, with the complete backing of the Pentagon. And none of that is presented in the U.S. media as the reality.
This year, we also saw the advancement of the struggle of workers to fight for a raise in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We had on Ronnie Rodriguez of the 15 Now, an organization that's been fighting in Seattle for a $15 minimum wage. He discussed the movement of low-wage workers and the struggle in Seattle that gained national attention.
People are moving in the struggle. You know, there's like 15 Now is actually branching out nationally. There's over 2 dozen cities that have started a 15 Now contingent and are getting out into the streets, having conversations with people. I think there's enough conscious anger. You know, it's just anger and discontent with the political establishment in this capitalist system that people are, I feel, have been waiting for some real change. You know, after being duped in the 2008 election and the financial crisis, people are really starting to question the conditions and the reasons and the officials who keep feeding them the same thing over and over again. You know, just saying that, you know, you have to choose between Democrats and Republicans, and not question the system, but just keep questioning, you know, who you're putting in the office, and we're getting nothing but more higher levels of poverty, higher tuition, higher rent. I mean, people are realizing that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer and are eager to address that problem. And I think having a clear, focused strategy on how we can move in the struggle and demonstrate how working class movements can really reshape the political landscape in communities and simultaneously, you know, across the country, you can only push people so far and into the ground until people are forced to, you know, to start standing up for themselves. And I feel that we've reached that point in Seattle, and people are watching, people are listening, people are moving into struggle, moving into action in their communities across the country. And just like with Seattle, coming right after SeaTac, SeaTac won $15 an hour minimum wage, and that was precedent setting. And now that opened the conversation that allowed Seattle to take from the lessons learned there and the momentum from that shift and be able to take that to, you know, the next city over, Seattle. And I think we're seeing that now in Mobile, Alabama, in Oakland, in New York City, in Los Angeles.
And of course, since then, we've seen some major wins in the fight to raise the minimum wage around the country, and the struggle still continues. This year, reports also exposed that there were massive corruption cases going on within the Department of the Veterans Affairs. Michael Preisner of March Forward investigated the VA corruption story that rocked the country.
Mistreatment of veterans and different types of scandals regarding veterans care is nothing new. But this story really broke when the Phoenix VA hospital was revealed to have a secret waiting list to cover up the backlog of appointments they weren't able to make for a veteran patient, on which about 40 veterans, at least 40 veterans, died while waiting for appointments. For example, a Vietnam-era veteran named Thomas Breen, who had cancer and was begging for months and months to be seen and to be treated, but he kept being pushed back on a waiting list, and after months, he succumbed to cancer without ever once being able to see a doctor. And so those really shocking stories, you know, showing the treatment of people who were really promised so much when they signed their life away to the military, turned into a really, really big scandal. And that's just the Phoenix VA hospital, and it's one of hundreds of VA hospitals and clinics around the country that are experiencing the exact same problem. So, you know, it became a scandal in the media. You know, why are veterans being treated in such a way? And it was used by many different political forces to call for different changes. And the change that has been made is the resignation of former four-star general Shinseki, who was the head of the VA secretary. And so, you know, he kind of took responsibility and stepped down. But, you know, this is a problem not just of an individual, but of an underfunded and understaffed system.
In July, the latest U.S.-sponsored Israeli assault on Gaza killed hundreds of innocent Palestinians. Richard Becker of the Answer Coalition gave us an immediate analysis about the historical precedent for Israel's brutal assault on Gaza and how the media was aiming to distort it.
On about, I think it was July 14th or 15th, there was an agreement that was made in Cairo, and the agreement was signed on to by the Israeli government, the Egyptian government. They negotiated it. The U.S. was for it. The Palestinian Authority, based in the West Bank, Mahmoud Abbas, supported it. But they didn't include Hamas in the negotiations, which, and Hamas is really still the governing party in reality in Gaza, even after the Palestinian Unity Agreement that was reached in April. And so they said, no, we reject this, and the terms of it did not include anything about loosening the blockade that both Israel and Egypt carry out against Gaza, which is causing so much suffering among the people. I mean, really, you know, where they don't have enough food, they don't have medicine, they don't have electricity most of the time, they don't have potable clean water to drink. I mean, this is really imposing collective punishment on a whole people, 1.8 million people in this area that's about totally twice the size of Washington, D.C. That's how big Gaza is. And so what Hamas has been demanding is that in exchange for a ceasefire, there should be an end to the blockade. And the Israelis and the U.S., and the Egyptian government have all refused that.
Probably one of the most significant stories here in the U.S. was the militant movement against police terror that was sparked by the reaction of the people in Ferguson, Missouri, to the killing of Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson. We've had coverage throughout the whole movement, and here was Eugene Perrier, organizer with Ferguson, D.C., as he spoke on the rebellion in Ferguson immediately after Mike Brown's tragic killing.
It doesn't really matter to a large degree what your social circumstances are. Just the fact of being black in America opens you up to the potential for extrajudicial killing. And I think that if you look, you know, at St. Louis and at Ferguson, but really at our country, it's not that surprising why people are angry. And I said this in a short piece I wrote on liberationnews.org. You know, this is anger and frustration at the fact that there is just an unbelievable amount of discrimination and oppression, whether it's poverty in general, whether it's unemployment, whether it's harassment and brutality by the police, all of these things that continue on a day-to-day basis. And very specifically to Ferguson, unbelievable political disenfranchisement in 2014 to have a city that's mostly black, that politically is still completely dominated by whites, that has a police department that is patrolling these poor black communities that is essentially completely white. And ultimately, it's not that surprising that when an issue like this happens, people rise up in anger because they are angry and frustrated, not just with the conditions, but the fact that from the public policy sphere, there's really only two responses that you get, which is somewhere between a continuum of, well, you know, we'd like to do more, but there's no money, to, well, it's their own fault for being poor and they should stop complaining. So I think all those factors added up together really allowed the tragic death of Michael Brown to become a catalyst, a spark for a lot of simmering tensions that exist, not just in Ferguson, but really in every major metropolitan area of this country with a significant population of black Americans. You know, everywhere you go in my neighborhood, you see people wearing an RIP so-and-so shirt, people of all ages. I've been to many vigils for black people killed in gang violence and drug violence and things like that, as have people in these communities. The people in these communities care way more than the people who are saying that no one cares about black-on-black violence. And it's a complete and absolute myth that there isn't a very significant movement of black people in this country against violence in our own communities. I mean, it's an absolute myth. There is not one person who has any amount of familiarity with black communities in the United States who will tell you there isn't a significant discussion and a significant undercurrent of people wanting to do things to stop violence in their community. And I think that, you know, the reason why people don't see it is the media doesn't cover it. You know, I went to a vigil of a 22-year-old man who was killed on his own porch in a violent situation, unfortunately, in Southeast D.C. just a few weeks ago. You know, there were hundreds of people there commemorating this man's life and putting out very impassioned calls for the violence to stop, and not one media source picked it up. So if the media perhaps was looking closer at this, and I think they just become desensitized to it, quite frankly, they report there's a shooting or a killing and that's it, unless it's one of the, you know, more sensationalized ones, people don't see that that's happening. But I view it as not only a huge myth, but extremely condescending, because I don't know, you know, I really want a lot of these people who are criticizing it to start posting on their social media and other places where they're sniping from the sidelines, start posting pictures of themselves at vigils of young people who have been killed. But as someone who's been to way too many of those, as someone who's tired of walking around in my own neighborhood and having to see 12-year-olds wearing T-shirts for, you know, friends and relatives who have been gunned down, it's absolutely absurd. But the reality of it is this, and this is the absolute key point. There are many black people in prison for killing other black people. There are basically no police officers, vigilantes, or security guards in prison for killing black people on the street. And that's the key difference. There's a license, an open season on black males in this country. And without a doubt, if you're wearing a badge or if you're some sort of George Zimmerman type vigilante, the law is 100% on your side and 100% against the black male. And so there's a huge imbalance in power and no accountability. And that's why people get so angry. That's why they get so angry. It's because there's no accountability at all. No one serves time for these crimes. And yet and still, the police are allowed to ride roughshod over poor black communities in every part of this country. And our right to be outraged, just as people are always outraged when these things happen. And everyone who's criticizing that, at least on this basis, should step to the rear on this, because they're dead wrong.
The state-sponsored disappearance of the 43 students in Ayotzinapa, Mexico, sparked mass resistance. Frank Lara, organizer with the PSO in San Francisco, discussed the outpouring that has shook the Mexican state.
On September 26th, 43 students from a school called one of the Normales in Mexico. A normal, just so people know, is one of these rural schools set up shortly after the Mexican Revolution. They were set up in order to educate some of the, you know, the poorest, most humble of the Mexican population, who usually came from families of campesinos. And they set up these schools all throughout the different rural areas in Mexico to educate these children to become teachers and go back to their communities and teach them. So with this, in this particular school called in Ayotzinapa, was one of these radical schools that actually was known for its history of raising very radical students, students that would get out and protest. And that particular day, they were supposedly heading over to a protest and protesting the mayor. And so they were detained at gunpoint, and several of them were shot and ran away. And when they started running away, 43 were caught and disappeared. Since then, obviously, not all the details are found. There was a lot of confusion shortly after with claiming that they had found some bodies. They actually went around looking for bodies out in some sites that people knew bodies were found in, and they found like 10 bodies here, 10 bodies there. And in a way, exposing just how horrific the violence is in Mexico, these bodies turned out not to be of the students, but of other people who've never been identified. And that repeated itself for several weeks in finding 30 bodies, you know, and the really there was a huge amount of pressure sent upon the current president Enrique Peña Nieto and the party, the PRI, which stands for El Partido Revolucionario Institucional, which is the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which was actually kicked out of power with the Nationalist Party, the Mexican Nationalist Party, PAN, was kicked out of for 2 terms, almost 12 years. And so when they've got, now that they got back into power, they've been pressured to answer the call of these parents and answer the missing, what happened with the missing students. So since then, there's been protests, there's been a lot of reaction, and the general sentiment that keeps bringing people to the street has been the fact that the government itself seems so incompetent in terms of bringing about any justice towards the family, and also any sense of being able to quell or to manage the violence, the uncontrolled violence that seems tied to the narco governments, tied to the state, in a relationship that is many times blurred and many times goes up to the highest levels of the government. So that's really the root of the issue.
This past September, we also saw some of the largest marches in U.S. history around the issue of climate justice, most notably with the People's Climate March in New York City. We were on the ground and able to interview many people during the march, and here are some of the voices from that day.
Yeah, man, I'm out here to fight capitalism because that's the root of the problem for environmental issues, and the people who's going to basically suffer from it are going to be basically the global poor, so in every country. So the rich are going to be able to go into their, you know, safe enclaves and keep all the resources that they've taken from everybody else. So it's up to us because they're definitely not going to do anything about it. So that's why I'm out here doing Excellent. My part.
Preston Wood, registered nurse and member of the PSL, discussed the Ebola crisis in the context of the historical plunder of Africa.
The colonial history, the pillaging of Africa, the plunder of its resources and labor, and the neglect that has occurred up to this day under the leadership of U.S. imperialism has made a situation where there's no structures or possible organization of society that would help make it possible to deal with a crisis like this. You need clinics, you need care centers, you need pharmacies, you need trained personnel, you need education of the people and outreach to people. And none of that has existed there and does not exist now. So it's a crisis that could have been averted because this is not a new disease. This has been around for a while, the Ebola virus. It could have been dealt with by investing funds and resources and people to actually build the kind of structures you need to handle this thing from an epidemiological point of view. So what we see is now the U.S. and the World Bank are saying they're going to start this process of building things, but we don't even know where that's going to go. They're saying, well, there's no water, there's no infrastructure, there's no electricity, it's going to be hard to build hospitals and the care centers they're talking about. And they're also saying, the U.S. is also saying, we're not going to be the ones to staff this. So it just shows you a disdain, really, and neglect and turning their back on a crisis that is, like, devastating a whole region of West Africa. When you have a contagious disease at the onset of a spreading epidemic, these are the things that not only impact the people who are suffering and denied care, but it enables the virus to spread because you aren't bringing people in. It's driving the disease underground, and it's going to exacerbate the problem rather than help it.
This year, we also saw some of the greatest attacks against the U.S. Postal Service. We had on Ken Lurch, president of the National Association of Letter Carriers, and he talked with us about the privatization and the struggle against it.
Right. Well, in January, their post office is planning on closing and consolidating 82 large mail processing and distribution centers, which will absolutely devastating cuts in service to the American people. And in fact, I believe these cuts will be so severe that they will forever damage the United States Postal Service and all mail, medicine, online purchases, local newspapers, bill payments, all types of mail will be delayed. And it's just a shame. It doesn't have to be. And this is all under the pretext that the Postal Service is losing money, which is not true. There was a law passed in 2006, the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, that forced the post office to pay $5.5 billion a year for future retiree health benefits, and that's something no other institution, public or private, is required to do. And it was just aimed at crippling the post office. But even with that, the American people still support the post office, so now they're trying to erode service in an effort to lower that support that the American people have for the post office. They want to privatize the post office.
And finally, this year ended with a great victory for the people's struggle with the freedom of the Cuban Five. Gloria LaRiva, national coordinator of the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five, discussed a 16-year-long struggle to free the Cuban Five and what this new shift in U.S.-Cuban relations means for the revolution.
It's a huge celebration taking place tonight, the night of their freedom, for all the Cuban people and especially for the Cuban families of the Cuban Five. Gerardo Hernandez, for example, hasn't been with his wife in 16 years. And that was a double punishment for them by the U.S. government. Ramon Labanino's three daughters are grown. But tonight, he's with his daughters, his wife. I spoke with them tonight. They're exceedingly happy. And Antonio Guerrero is with his mother, sister, and all his family members. His mother, who is in her late 70s, was fearful that she wouldn't survive before he came home. Well, now they're all home, all five. It's a giant victory for the people of Cuba. Normalizing relations simply means that the U.S. and Cuba will set up official, full diplomatic relations, meaning embassies, instead of interest sections, which are a quasi-diplomatic relation. Now they will have full embassies. And Obama also said that the licensing for people-to-people exchange, allowing U.S. citizens and residents to travel to Cuba, will be eased up somewhat, but still there is a travel ban. And the U.S. blockade, the economic blockade, all the laws that entail a blockade, which internationalize sanctions and fines against countries and companies that do business with Cuba, heavy, heavy fines totaling billions of dollars against corporations, countries, and banks, still exists. So the struggle for real normal relations between both countries is not over by any means. The blockade has caused over $1.2 trillion of damage to the Cuban economy and the people. It doesn't benefit the Cuban people in any way. It's really an act of genocide. And the American people have suffered as well. The fact that we can't travel to the island freely, that we can't see what a socialist society works like, how and why the people have free health care, free education, social peace. They don't have to worry about being gunned down by cops, being beaten to death by cops, as has happened here in the U.S. And I think a glimpse into Cuban society by the American people being able to visit would really, really open our eyes.
We'll continue our look back at news and events around the world and around the nation in 2014 tomorrow. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.